Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Neil Smelser, who is University Professor Emeritus of Sociology at UC Berkeley and former director of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. He is a former president of the American Sociological Association, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and a fellow of the American Academy of Political and Social Sciences. He's the author of 14 books, including The Theory of Collective Behavior. His most recent book is The Social Edges of Psychoanalysis, published by UC Press, and his forthcoming book is called The Social Sciences and the Understanding of Terrorism, to be published by the National Academy of Sciences. Neil, welcome back to Berkeley and welcome to our program.
Thank you, Harry.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born on a farm in northeastern Missouri, same farm my mother was born on, though my mother and father were both school teachers, and my father got a teaching job in Phoenix, Arizona when I was an infant. I moved out there at the age of 6 weeks. And lived in Phoenix for the first 18 years of my life.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Profoundly. They were both academics. My father was taught first speech and drama, then philosophy, very much interested in the social and political problems of the day. My mother was a humanist, taught Latin and English, and was strongly into the world of music. So all of these things laid out for me in my childhood, and it was an easy exposure in a small city of Phoenix at that time that was not specially cultivated. They were very important influences.
And was your education in Phoenix such that you were prepared for Harvard when you went there as an undergraduate?
I went to Phoenix Union High School, which was a rainbow high school, and it was I had the blessing of having quite a number of extremely good teachers, and of course I was always exposed, mostly via my father, to a lot of things that you didn't get in high school. So I moved into Harvard and did not find myself overwhelmed by the level and demandingness of the place.
And then after Harvard, you were a Rhodes Scholar.
That's right, from 52 to 54, Magdalen College.
Right, and then back to Harvard
for
your PhD, where you were also a member of a junior fellow of the Society of Fellows.
That's right. I was in Harvard from 54 to 58, and three of those years were in the Society of Fellows. I came to Berkeley immediately thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this education, you must have had a lot of choices as to what you would go into, and in a minute we're going to talk about your two careers as a sociologist and a psychoanalyst, but what led you to social theory?
Well, I had two alternative careers in mind when I went to Harvard. One came directly from my father, who's teaching philosophy in a community college at the time, and I, early in my college career, took several courses in philosophy and found that wasn't exactly to my liking. I was also seriously considering becoming a journalist because I had worked as a newspaper reporter in my high school and throughout my college years. But I must say I discovered the world of journalism to have too high a level of cynicism in it. And my brother was a clinical psychologist in training, and I, in a way, didn't want to become exactly that. The field of social relations at Harvard offered me a lot of opportunities, and I gradually, without any particular moment of decision, decided that sociology was what I wanted.
And you wound up focusing on what you call the social structural level, in the macroscopic social structural level. Tell us a little about what that means. You're looking at the big social structures in society. Help us understand what you do as a sociologist.
Well, I should only mention by example the kinds of social structures that interested me most in my historical work. That was a social structure of industry, the roles, the level of differentiation, the division of labor, the location and specialization of production, the family, roles in the family, which is a social structure, and then primary education. In a way, you can look at that historical work as linking those three structures. Changes in the industrial experience of children put a lot of pressure on the family, or changed the family profoundly if they didn't have children earning money. And it also opened up the pressure to get those children in school rather than be idle at home or on the streets. So what I did was really try to analyze the context by which structural change in these institutions took place. And that's the macro level. I mean, you're not dealing with the person, you're dealing with the larger systems.
So in a way, your intellectual odyssey is struggling with one problem, which then suggests the next problem, and you go on to
that. It works out that way. It's not a plan.
Yeah.
But when you work on something persistently, new things come into view, and some of those new things are attractive to you intellectually, and you can take up at least a portion of those in your next project.
What are the temperament and skills required for what a sociologist does and for what you do as a sociologist?
Well, I'd say the most important personal characteristic is the capacity to objectify. Practically all the subject matter of sociology is also the subject of ideology and strong personal feelings. Think about religion, think about family, think about work even. These are subjects of loaded with meaning and loaded with ideology, and practically everybody has their own theory about them, usually derived from their own experience. What you have to do as a sociologist is to move away from these biographical particularities of your own life and of other people's lives, and to try to take that's what I mean by objectification, to treat these experiences as objects for study rather than swimming through them in your own lifetime. So I guess the simple answer to your question is the objectification of social reality.
And where looking back on your career, what are the sources, the conditions that help us understand your most creative moments, basically? Where does creativity lie? Is it in part seeing the elements of a problem embedded in a problem that you've just worked with, or what?
I would describe it as a kind of an unfolding process. Perhaps I can illustrate. Later in my career, I decided to go back to the study of Victorian England. My dissertation was on changes in family life in Victorian England, and that was where that impulse to look at education, which was so intimately connected, came from. I didn't get around to education until 30 years later. But it was still there, that kernel of... But anything that's creative about that transition was not an immediate insight. It was an accumulation of changing of directions, of letting the subject matter speak to you, of making new connections that you perhaps didn't even have before in mind. So I would say creativity is not a moment, it's a process. And it's very hard to put your finger on it. I suppose one could mention moments of insight in one's career that turned out to be original and extremely productive, but it doesn't happen that way. It's not a snap of the fingers. It's accumulation of experiences and the gradual falling together of connected elements that makes for creativity.
One of your books that we're going to be talking about, which I'm going to show our audience right now, is The Social Edges of Psychoanalysis, published by UC Press, and there are it's a collection of essays that you've written over the lifetime of your career, and I want to pursue some of the issues, but one of the things that you focus on there is academic disciplines, both the constraints of academic disciplines and the opportunities that they pose. You're really in a position to look at your field of sociology and make some general observations about how it's evolved in the time of your career, and what does that tell us about academic disciplines generally?
Well, do you want me to comment on sociology?
Yeah, sure, that would be
great. In particular?
That would be good. And then we'll talk about psychoanalysis in a minute.
Okay, well, sociology has in some sense not changed very much, in the sense that it's... two primary and overwhelming preoccupations are, first, the development of some kind of scientific viewpoint and scientific method about the study of society, and second, a reformist impulse that it finds in its very beginnings in the progressive period in the United States. And they form not only the key elements of sociological investigation, but the key points of tension in the field. And in a way, a lot of the history of the field has been battling between these two impulses, the reformist and the scientific, which again calls for much more of this objectivity and distance from the subject matter. The field, as I've experienced it, beginning in the 1950s, was in a period of heavy and high optimism about the promise of social science. This got really dashed in the 60s. Not that people didn't think it was an important thing to do. As a matter of fact, it became much more popular and visible in those times, but it got corralled momentarily, at least, to the reform impulse that was so lively in the 60s and part of the 70s. And since that time, it's kind of settled into a multiplicity of disciplines. I'd say that its fragmentation and differentiation is the key of the last 25 years, and it keeps getting bounced into by various intellectual movements, such as feminism, such as postmodernism, and it absorbs some, resists others, and gradually accumulates a new, more complex richness of its own. I think a lot of people think the field doesn't know where it is, and that's in large part because it's accumulated so many different perspectives and never sheds very many of them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about psychoanalysis, because that is a secondary career. Can we say that you majored in sociology and minored in psychoanalysis? What led
well,
you to...
Well, the culture of Harvard at the time I was an undergraduate and graduate student was really dominated by Freudian psychology. I mean, it was most of the faculty members were sympathetic to that approach, and many of them had gone through the psychoanalytic training that was available to non-medical personnel. I was drawn into this. I appreciated its strengths. Never became a convert, but was very much exposed and kind of knew, I think, even at that time, that it was going to be a part of my career, though I couldn't. I didn't want to be going to medical school, and I wasn't sure exactly what it would be. I knew it would be an intellectual part of my life. When I was relatively young, about 30 years, I had a breakup of a marriage and a kind of an accompanying personal crisis, and I decided to seek help, but to seek help in the context of a training analysis, that is to say, a full training of a non-medical practitioner, which was by that time possible. In other words, mm-hmm. I took the full training, no inhibitions, and in fact, I became licensed as a psychoanalyst in the state of California to practice if I wanted. I haven't followed a full practice. I've been a therapist and a supervisor off and on in different times of my career, but it became, the psychoanalysis was a fundamental personal experience for me and became a permanent part of my intellectual outlook, and at different times, often being asked, but often sometimes on my own steam, I would write on subjects that attracted me, which I thought had a potential from the development of depth psychology. And the result is that book of some 15 essays, I think, written over about a 30-year period.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk then a little about the temperament and skills required for psychoanalysis. Are they the same or very different?
Overlapping. I would say they're overlapping. The capacity for objectification is clearly there. In other words, if you're treating a patient who is highly disturbed or emotional or obviously full of pain, you have to be able to appreciate what that is, but you have to kind of move mm-hmm. a step away, mm-hmm. combining sympathy with objective efforts to understand. And of course, the big difference is that we were talking about structures earlier. The whole thing about psychoanalysis is the person. In fact, the field is somewhat oblivious to the larger structural arrangements, except insofar as they become grist for the person's psychological dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Now, in one of the essays here, well, there are actually several that you address this problem, which has been an element in your career, namely interdisciplinary work.
Yes.
I should mention to our audience that for many years you were associate director of the Institute of International Studies, which sponsors this program. You, in an essay on Erickson, you write this. Now, when a psychoanalyst or any kind of discipline-oriented scholar makes such a commitment to become more comparative, more historical, more developmental, and more incorporative of different analytic levels in his work, this necessarily generates a tension, a kind of disciplinary unease or discomfort. That tension arises from an inevitable pressure to relativize the universals of one's discipline. Talk a little about that, because I think
Thank you for reading that. I hadn't recalled the exact words. It's not bad, actually.
It's good, yeah. So tell us why it's good.
Well, in a way, it's comfortable to operate within the confines of a discipline, and economics is an extreme case. Here you are, you have a very elaborated set of simplifying assumptions about the world, and by making those elaborated and simplified assumptions, you can generate technical solutions much more easily than you can with a looser set of parameters in the world. And the disciplines differ in the degree to which they're tight or loose in this regard. But the unease I was referring to is that when you want to relax some of those givens, mm-hmm. if you want to take the propensity to consume as an inner dynamic rather than an assumption, mm-hmm. then you've got to move outside. You lose some of that theoretical specificity that these simplifying assumptions give you, but at the same time, you become closer in touch with reality. The problem is to spread out, but at the same time, maintain discipline. That's the real tension with interdisciplinary work, I've always discovered. And in a way, you have to make up your own discipline, small d, mm-hmm. because it's not supplied in any automatic way when thinking about two approaches at the same time. There's a synthesis that has to go on. I might say that this interest in interdisciplinary started early. The social relations department was an interdisciplinary department.
This is at Harvard.
At Harvard, when I was an undergraduate and graduate student. I studied philosophy, politics, and economics at Oxford. My doctoral dissertation was a historical study informed by sociological frameworks. And of course, going into psychoanalysis with yet another extension into the world of special part of the world of psychology. So this has kind of been in my blood, and I suppose that the statement I made about that, about interdisciplinarity in that essay, was probably a kind of biographical.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I know you thought a lot about the history of intellectual communities and so on, and you've run the Center for Advanced Studies in Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, California, not at Stanford University. And I'm just curious, what are the kinds of environments that are conducive to making possible the most rewarding outcomes from interdisciplinary work?
Well, I can tell you first an environment that's not very conducive, and that's the university itself. Mm-hmm. Is structural division into departments, the building of departments around disciplines, the building of careers within disciplines, all conspire toward a narrowing and more specialized line of inquiry, and most people in the various fields tend to go that route. Mm-hmm. Tend to make their careers out of more specialized mm-hmm. work, and they continue to do it within the confines of the specialization that they chose in the first place or that they've been working in. And the atmosphere of the university, with the department in particular, is to reward that career line. It seems to me that aside from any personal predilections one might have toward thinking more broadly or more comprehensively, I would have to say that someplace like the center is extremely conducive, because you bring people in there, it has no organization. Mm-hmm. There are no departments, no age levels, no seniority levels, no nothing. Everybody is equal. Everybody is in there doing their own work, but everybody is systematically exposed, not in a compulsory, but in an unstructured way to everybody else. Mm-hmm. And things begin to spark. And we have had so many testimonies in the reports and the follow-ups of the scholars who went to the center, of contacts they made, mm-hmm. Friends they established, intellectual influences on them outside their own field, which changed their work, sometimes in minor, but sometimes in major ways. I think to introduce people into an unstructured situation of that sort probably leads to a kind of encouragement of destructuring their own mm-hmm. thinking. I realize this is a kind of biographical statement, and I could probably think of other kinds of settings. Yeah. The Society of Fellows was a similar kind of experience because people came from everywhere, and you necessarily, just through personal interaction, got exposed to their viewpoints.
In your presidential address to the American Sociological Association, you focused on the concept of ambivalence, which is quite interesting. So my first question is to tell us about that concept. But secondly, was that a product of the confluence of two disciplines here, psychoanalysis and sociology, or was it independent of that?
Well, I got influence from both sides, I suppose. From the psychoanalytic side, psychoanalysis from its classical days has undergone a lot of changes. And a lot of the original Freudian formulations, such as the primal horde, the life wish and death wish, some of the aspects of the theory of dreams, the Oedipus complex, a lot of that have been either discredited or highly qualified. But in my own experience and in becoming acquainted with the history and nature of psychoanalytic thought, I saw that one of the most vital and unyielding concepts was that of ambivalence. The idea is that toward an object, or toward another person, or toward an idea, one can simultaneously, and usually does simultaneously, hold both positive and negative attitudes or orientations. And that these are parts of your own psychic reality, but they're not the most comfortable part of your psychic reality. The world isn't simple enough if you have to think that all the time about you're both drawn and repelled by something. So the tendency is to simplify this and to categorize more into absolutes one's likings. But if you get into it, even I think I gave the example in my presidential address that in a parade of presidents through which one's life has gone, one usually clearly has preferences. Mm-hmm. And you, on the surface, think of someone you really really detest. Mm-hmm. But when you begin to think about it, you begin to uncover that it's not all that simple. Mm-hmm. That even your heroes have their problems, and maybe your villains have their virtues, and you have to recognize that. Well, from the psychoanalytic side, it's a persistent and valuable perspective. There's a notion of sociological ambivalence that isn't so developed, but nonetheless is important, and that has to do with the structuring of contradictory expectations into the similar role. Mm-hmm. In other words, that leads you to be both drawn into and away from that particular role. There have been analyses of the medical role, of the role of wife and husband, of children, whatever, that simultaneously attract and repel or demand and prohibit behavior, so that there is a kind of confluence there. The main thing that led me to kind of go into more and more areas in which it seemed to be applicable is that it yielded a great deal of intellectual harvest for mm-hmm. me. That you could understand a lot of things about otherwise perplexing phenomenon by understanding the orientations that people have, which are ambivalence and insoluble, mm-hmm. and therefore repetitive, mm-hmm. because they keep trying to solve these ambivalences, which won't go away, but... And that isn't the sort of way we Americans think of things. We tend to think of things as problem solving, as you have a problem, well, you work it through, you solve it, you get a result. Mm-hmm. Life isn't that way. Life is a constant struggle over the same battles that you've been fighting all your life.
And this notion offers a nice balance to the social sciences, where there's really has been a heavy emphasis on what is called rational choice theory, where these kinds of issues are put aside.
This was the starting point of my presidential address, was to take economic theory of rationality, which was univalent, utility. Mm-hmm. What attracts you? Well, there's disutility too, but the two never mix together. So that's univalent and not very emotional mm-hmm. as a theory. I took this as a starting point of the limitations and said, well, look, there are types of situations in which that kind of rationality seems to apply, and that means mainly the institutionalization of choice. But when you get the institutionalization of relationships that are in which you have no choice, in which you're dependent, that's where ambivalence thrives. You're in them and you can't get out of them. I mean, these, of course, parent-child relationship, and many, many others we could identify. And this, to me, led me to insights on a whole wide range of phenomena that I think are otherwise not connected except by this idea that they run on ambivalence.
Is it fair to say that ambivalence has intrigued you as a scholar all along? Because there is, in your work, a remarkable capacity to see all sides of issues and to attempt to synthesize them and integrate them.
Yes, that was in my work earlier before I even got acquainted with psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
Partially accepting and partly rejecting the standard formulations and explanations of things, that's ambivalence at work.
Mm-hmm.
The word actually shows up in some of my early work, which I didn't realize until I went back and took a look, and it was there. I often start off a book by indicating that ambivalence is what really drives us. Even in my methodological book on comparative analysis, I started out about the ambivalence toward the different, mm-hmm. toward what's different from us, and that's what holds back a lot of objective comparative analysis. The other is always a subject of ambivalence. But that sort of came out. I didn't plot it out as a result of some formal training. But that's, I guess, it's kind of the story of my life.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about cultural trauma. One of the, in preparation for this interview, I read, at your suggestion, an essay on cultural trauma, which I guess was written at about the time of 9/11. So let's do this. Let's say, help us understand the event of 9/11 as a cultural trauma, drawing on insights that might come from your sociology background, but then on the other hand from your background in psychoanalysis.
Well, the idea of social trauma or cultural trauma has come into the literature in the past 10 or 15 years. Via history, psychology, anthropology, sociology, not so much political science and economics, but maybe political science to some degree. The idea is that certain historical events are so profound in their cultural and personal impact that they develop the features that resemble psychological trauma. Namely, that they're permanently unsettling, that you can't forget about them, even if you try to forget about them. There's a kind of compulsive need to relive and re-experience. cultural traumas are mainly negative, but not exclusively so. And I'd been working with a number of scholars at the center in the 3 years before 9/11. And our project was the nature of cultural trauma. And we focused comparatively and theoretically on events such as the Holocaust, the transformation of life in Eastern Europe, pre-communist, communist, post-communist, American slavery, things of this sort. And when 9/11 came along, in a way I was quite poised to identify these very elements which 9/11 manifested. I wrote the essay 4 months after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed to me to have all the earmarks of what we had kind of identified as cultural trauma. And the essay is to explore the strengths and limitations of that concept to describe 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Now, in one element of the formulation you come up with, which I think is very interesting, is you say something like, every effort to establish a cultural trauma is a contested process. And when one thinks about 9/11, sometimes hidden from view was the fight as to how we will define it and what we will do in response to it. And I think that's a kind of very interesting
part
point.
Part of the collective memory.
Yeah.
Is who owns it?
Yeah.
And of course, you see the parties. The Republicans are claiming they own it,
mm-hmm.
And are responsible for responding to it, and it's their property and it's their political property, and it should be remembered in certain ways and not in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Pearl Harbor should be remembered as a sneak attack on the United States, and to forget about the fact that it was partially provoked. These are the kinds of contests, and of course, collective memory of traumatic events becomes a commodity over which people fight and over which they generate their own positions. The memory of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki is such an example. That's a kind of trauma, right? And if you look at American politics, you see different groups jockeying over how that should be remembered. Veterans groups, peace groups, whatever. And you can't really, Enola Gay, controversy, whatever. That's what I mean by contestation. And we see it in relatively more smaller areas. I wouldn't call the replacement of the World Towers as small, but nonetheless, that's been totally a contest as to exactly how we should remember this event. And that's really pretty much how we understand aftermath of all traumas, the French Revolution, the Holocaust, just name it, you find it becomes a point of contest in contemporary politics over the meaning of history and over the meaning of memory.
This collection from that you've done for UC Press, and I will show it again, The Social Edges of Psychoanalysis. A number of the essays were written early in your career, and it was remarkable the extent to which they resonate with the issues we're going through right now. One essay in particular was called The Problem of Evil, I think, and in which you, and I think the article was written in response to the My Lai massacres at that time. Talk a little about that, because is that one of the rewarding things of the work that you do, is that because your analysis of the macrostructural level, you're really laying out the elements of the puzzle in such a way that when we turn back to that puzzle and act as if it wasn't addressed, in fact, it was.
Absolutely. The ingredients repeat themselves, and I suppose there's a certain perverse joy that a social scientist gets in seeing the world repeat itself, even though it is not always pretty, what you see repeating. In the in this essay, this is not bragging, it's just a fact, in this essay on the cultural trauma, there are two paragraphs in there in which I predict what happened with respect to American unilateralism.
Well, you talk about the Lone Ranger, and yes.
And also exactly how frail the balance between the balance of unilateralism is given the world situation and given our own cultural predispositions to initiating aggression. And it has unfolded. I don't take any particular pride in being a predictor or a seer in this regard, but you just bring together what's known about past conflicts and what the ingredients that appear are, it becomes evident that these things are not entirely novel.
You actually, in this essay, I think it's very fair to say that you you're remarkable in this essay in objectifying, which is what you chose as your career code, in laying out the problem of evil, and let's say that evil is on the other side, and you say how you pose these questions: how is evil legitimated, how is it authorized, how are people mobilized to do evil, and how is evil rationalized? So in those four questions, you give us a vehicle for looking at the adversary we now confront, if we, for purposes of analysis, accept that there is evil on the other side.
That could have been a script for our dealing with terrorism, as you now read those questions. It is. This has come somewhat out of my past work in ideologies of social movements, all of which have some version of those questions there. Even very mild social movements always point the finger at somebody. They're not always an absolute evil, but they are responsible for. And so I had teased out these ingredients from a lot of comparative study of ideologies. Incidentally, if you talk about objectification, I did not want to use the word evil as much as I wanted to use the word destructive behavior.
Right.
Because that was an ideologized term as well, and that, once again, I was trying to get a little bit of distance from it. The whole conference on this was was a heavily emotional condemnation of American policies in Vietnam, which I shared, But I thought that doesn't help as much in exactly understanding what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You actually refer to and I should have given this definition, situations when force, violence, and other forms of coercion exceed institutional or moral limits. The beauty of that definition, of course, it helps us understand the ways in which our side is violating some of the institutional norms that we have established over time in terms of dealing with it.
One of the blessings of democracy is that we have enough people in our own society who see those things and who call attention to them, and it becomes part of the partisan process rather than something that is completely doctrinaire or fully accepted or indeed totalitarian.
Mm-hmm. Now, your recent work is, as we said, on the social sciences and our understanding of terrorism, and your book will be published in the spring by the National Academy. How did you come to be involved in this work, and what is it that sociology and can tell us about what terrorism is and the nature of the problem?
My own involvement came more or less immediately after 9/11. I hadn't studied this phenomenon much beyond being casually acquainted with it as a form of conflict. But after 9/11, everybody mobilized after 9/11. That's part of the trauma. And the National Academy of Sciences kind of volunteered its own efforts to understand and contribute toward the understanding of terrorism in the way that sciences might. I was made a member of a major committee that published a report called Making the Nation Safer. It was mostly other kinds of scientists. There are only two social scientists on it. And that spawned out two subcommittees, one on the limitations of deterrence and one on what the behavioral and social sciences might say. I chaired those last two. So I was drawn in the first 6 months after 9/11, into really active intellectual engagement with the problem. I sort of became a scholar, whether I liked it or not. And in the wake of that, I've served on various advisory committees and panels and whatever through the national academies on activities related to terrorism, including in some advisory work with the Homeland Security Department. I sort of had an idea. A few people said to me at the time I was on these committees, you ought to put this into a book, mm-hmm. right? Because I was beginning to really, a lot of my past was very relevant to it. And so the National Academies Press and I negotiated out a project where I would write a book on the subject. Social sciences. Terrorism has been studied remarkably little by the social scientists. Mm-hmm. Political scientists, some policymakers, and a few psychologists have been the main ones to be interested in it. It's been kind of left alone by sociologists, by anthropologists, and by economists, with some exceptions. And the literature on it now is not very good, or not very many people go into it. For reasons, it's a mystery. I don't know exactly why. But there's a lot of social science that's relevant. I mean, just think of the literature on social movements. You can't understand what's going on in Middle Eastern countries without the direct application of a lot of things we know generally about social movements. And that whole question about when does evil get perpetrated and how to get legitimized and so on, these are things that have been thought about by psychologists and by sociologists in various ways. So it's moving general insights that we have about these phenomena in on the understanding of terrorism. The whole idea of recruitment resembles very much processes such as religious conversion, and there's a rich literature on that which comes to bear. Small group processes and understanding what goes on in these cells. They can't study the cells very well, but you can make some inferences out of related social science work. Reaction to disaster, sociology of disaster, is very relevant to the whole issues of warning and preparation and reaction to attack. So as much of that book as anything is bringing together all these different lines of independent social science work which throw light and help explain something that's very, very difficult to study directly.
Now, you propose a strategy, but before we talk about that, we'll talk about it in one second. You point out something, and I want you to explain this to our audience, because it's some conclusions you reached about the nature of terrorism, which suggests a problem with some of our responses. You say you're talking about your strategy of discouragement, and you can explain that in a minute. You say this strategy recognizes the contingent, long-term, probabilistic, and never foolproof problem that we're dealing with. And then it recognizes the need for a multiplicity of adaptive strategies. So terrorism, you're saying, is something that's not going to go away.
That's precisely correct. And furthermore, terrorism is not as we, as a nation under attack, and as heritage, an American heritage, have defined it. We have tended to define it in moralistic mm-hmm. terms and as instrumental terms. Mm-hmm. A problem to be solved, a war to be won, right?
And we're the good guys.
And we're the good guys, that's the moralistic side. Mm-hmm. And then the war to be won is the instrumental side. I have a little catchphrase in my preface to that book that refers to this mentality as gadgets, game theory, and goodness. Mm-hmm. As constraining our response to terrorism, which doesn't recognize it for what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's contingent, it's long-term, it's organized in such a way it can't be settled by conventional wartime wartime measures. It's likely that we can't influence many of the conditions that give rise to it. And it is a method which defies our conventional way of dealing with force and violence in our midst. Police powers are not exactly right. Armies are certainly not the right way to go after it. And so we need invention, and we also need to recognize that because it has got there's so many multiple causes that go into the process. And earlier in the book, I try to analyze the kind of cumulative determinants that eventuate in the terrorist inclined group. And my positive strategy comes out of the idea that you can't solve this problem once and for all. You've got to scratch at it in its many manifestations, and in that way discourage it, not prevent it, mm-hmm. and not beat it in a war, and not. It's a kind of a combination I explained of a theory of containment and a theory of deterrence put together, but in a very new rationale.
And your list includes you modify the conditions of terrorism, you attack terrorism at its source, assembling reliable intelligence, you stop the flow of resources, you discredit their ideologies, you diminish support groups, you monitor movement of people and weapons at the border, and you harden potential targets. Basically, is this? Do you think there's an audience for this in Washington?
The audience, the toughest way to get that message through, which says you are confronted with a granite rock, and the way you get that granite rock is you scratch at it, and you're lucky if you find a place you can hold on to or chip away at. This is so far from the dominant mentality. I don't think it'll be listened to. I think it's sensible, and I think it's right. I think it respects the nature of the beast, right? And it's not especially dramatic. It's not terribly sexy. It doesn't say, here's a problem, we're going to eradicate it. We're going to either destroy it or cure it. That's the mentalities that are all around. And so I expect this book, I modestly say the book is very sensible. But sensibility is not the major orientation that almost all contending parties in the terrorism arena share. Mm-hmm. It's one of these. It's an area. It's very threatening. It makes for nonsensible solutions. And unfortunately, the ineffectiveness that we've seen in dealing with terrorism reflects that. The confusion.
In your last chapter, you were looking at the United States and its place in the world as a constraint, actually, on the process of moving toward more sensible policies, if that's a fair restatement of what you're saying. But I want to focus on this notion, because you really see a very important ambivalence on our part in the way we deal with the world, because we have so much economic power and so much
military
and to a lesser extent some compelling ideas, ideological ideas, which we...
Culture.
Talk a little about that problem, because we have to get over that hump, and you really believe that in looking at the unilateral versus the multilateral, or hard power versus soft power, you really tilt toward the latter in both cases.
I don't rule out the hard power. I mean, I think a reasonably intelligent use of military force did occur in Afghanistan. We somewhat botched it up afterwards, but nonetheless, here was a case where there was a a terrorist base in a nation run by a national group, and we were getting at it, right? And so that I do not argue against military interventions, though I argue strongly about how selective they have to be and how targeted they have to be, and that war is not a very good weapon against them. What I have in mind is that I try to do a kind of a cost-benefit analysis, if you will, or a costs and gains analysis of these different approaches to the world. You see, it seems to me that most of the post-war success, post-World War II success of the United States, when it emerged as the hegemonic, if you want to use that word, power, is it never used all the power it had, right? There was a lot of shoving around, a lot of influencing, and a lot of sanctioning, and some war-making. But the triumphs of the recovery of post-war Europe, of the maintenance of basically a stable, if unhappy, situation in the Cold War, so on, all dependent on a kind of restraint. And that's tough in a society that is so strong and in a country that is so powerful in all the ways we mentioned, that you're tempted to just muscle through because you can, right? And that's particularly true of war. We're the champion war makers and unchallengeable by conventional war at present time. Tendencies to take that literally and to muscle the world around. Well, the world isn't that simple. And the costs that I tried to fix on that, both international and domestic, are such that you simply have to come up with a much more contingent view of how we work to solve these intractable problems in the world.
In the book, The Social Edges of Psychoanalysis, interestingly enough, there's another essay that really struck me because it relates what we were just talking about, namely the influence of theory on policy. And you say this, let me quote you, "Yet neither psychoanalysis nor sociology in uncovering such irritating and pressing knowledge, that is, you revealing the truths, the structures hidden both in the mind and in society, neither of these disciplines is in a position of being able to say exactly what should be done with the knowledge in a moral sense." So there is a point at which these are not, work like yours is not necessarily a formula, I guess, for how we should act in the world in an era of terrorism, but rather a statement that seeks to lay out all the structures in place. Is that fair?
I conclude the final chapter of the book, if you remember, by saying what is absolutely essential is to recognize these realities, and that any benefit that we can contribute is enlightenment, not specific solutions. But if those ingredients of our, say, fight against terrorism continue to be unconscious and under the surface, we're going to make no headway, because our debates and our understanding will not progress beyond these repetitive kind of ensnarlments that we've got ourselves into in thinking about it. So consciousness raising, that is extremely powerful, because you redefine the issues. If you take this knowledge seriously, you don't generate a final solution, and no one could pretend. I mean, no knowledge is a final solution because so many contingencies are at hand. And they're not responsible for the solutions, but they are responsible for edification and enlightenment and consciousness raising.
Mm-hmm. What have we've covered a lot in this interview. Of course, you've done so much that it's impossible to cover it all, but I did want to briefly talk about another role that I know that you've had is an advisor to chancellors on this campus. And I'm curious a little about to what extent you learned anything new about what we were just talking about, namely the relationship that theory can have in elucidating problems that are before chancellors, like affirmative action, like social disturbance, and so mm-hmm. on. Did the fact that you were at Berkeley and had insights, which they clearly wanted to listen to, did that make a difference? And in what ways did it make a difference, or did you still confront the same limits that we've just been talking about?
Well, I think I did some good. The role that I was most important, I think, in this general advisory role came in the right in the middle of the free speech movement. I was called into the acting Chancellor Meyerson's office to be his special advisor in the area of student political activity. So I was a negotiator with free speech movement people and a lot of other movements, and I was also in his cabinet. And I found a culture in the chancellor's office that was the following, that we're confronted with a kind of evil out there, mm-hmm. and that these people are thinking all the time how they can make our lives impossible, mm-hmm. how they're going to destroy us, really. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, they're planning all the time. and furthermore, they know what they're doing. It was a kind of a almost conspiratorial, mm-hmm. and the free speech movement had the same view of the administration. They're plotting precisely how to get them, as though they were the center of our attention, and we had a plan, and we didn't make a move without knowing a part of that plan, and so on. So there was an imposition of complete rationality to the other party in both cases, whereas the reality was both sides were bumbling, right? And I could see that. And I kind of brought, and I saw that in my own studies, actually, of social movements. So I think I brought some intelligence to bear, saying, these people are as confused as we are, and we don't take the bait, mm-hmm. and we don't fall into that game of responding, but because the whole culture of the administration was nothing can happen without our making the proper response. The idea was, look, they're as confused as we are. If we let this one die, it's going to go away in a week, right? And if we try to punish these people or land on them or take some strong counteraction, there's going to be more cost than gain. And I think that voice was somewhat heard during the period in which I was there. And that's, I guess, what you call application of knowledge.
One final question. If students were to watch this interview, how would you advise them to prepare for the future? If they see sociology and academic studies, or just in the social sciences generally, as part of their future,
I would. I guess my advice would have to be rather trite, and that would be to somehow or other strive toward a world outlook, and that your education can help you in this. That combines. Criticism with responsibility. Our country would not survive without internal criticism. And those times in which it has teetered near the edge of real trouble is when that criticism becomes a basis for acting irresponsibly, both by government, by protest groups, by citizens, by whatever, McCarthy, you just name it. Mm-hmm. That the bomb, the healing of the society, is this mix of criticism and responsibility.
Neil, on that positive note, I want to thank you for taking time to be here today, and thank you for writing all that you've written.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.